Welcome to Grumpy Strategists episode 23, brought to you by Strategic Analysis Australia. I'm Michael Shoebridge and I'm here with SAA's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer. Marcus.
Hello, Bill. I'm going to call you Bill today after Chernobyl, because today we're going to debate the big issues around nuclear power.
So we're going to try and have a civil nuclear debate, and I mean that in both powerful meanings of civil.
Yeah, bring it on, Shoebridge.
This is not about nuclear weapons or nuclear submarines. It's about civilian nuclear power. And the debate, Dr. Hellyer, is to stay civil.
Right, so, okay, stay civil.
They're the ground rules.
Okay, Bill, I got that.
Our purpose here is to try and have a discussion about the fundamentals in the energy debate in Australia and the potential role of nuclear and the pluses and minuses around renewables, nuclear, and the current path. We will engage with the coalition nuclear power plan because that is a part of this bigger debate, but we're really just trying to sketch the boundaries of the debate so that a bunch of Australians and anyone else listening to this mighty fine podcast can at least have some common foundations to discuss the issue.
And I'll just note, one reason we're doing this is A, it's an important issue, but B, we're kind of sick of agreeing with each other all the time. So we decided we're deliberately going to disagree. And both of us have children with very distinguished high school debating careers. And so we thought we would take that model where we will pick a side and represent that side, regardless of whether we actually agree with that side or not.
So today, Marcus is
the good guy
wearing a green shirt. I think that tells you all you need to know. He's on the renewables are the answer side of the debate. I'm in a dark suit, and that's quite deliberate. I'm more the Darth Vader,
very big
Death Star,
on.
Nuclear power is our future side of the debate. So that's who we are for the purposes of the discussion. Let's get started. We're going to cover some core foundational stuff, starting with looking at Australia. How much energy do we need? What are we producing now from what? And can renewables scale in the time and to the volume required to meet future demand? Can nuclear do that? And what are the ups and downsides around each of these? So, Marcus, how much energy does Australia currently need every day in 2024?
Okay, so we'll talk electricity. So we're talking electricity here, not all energy, but as we move forward in time, more of our energy usage will be electrified as more of us drive electric vehicles. And there'll also be other drivers for the use of electricity as AI takes over. And we'll be running lots and lots of huge servers and storage farms and things like that. So there's no debate that our requirement for electricity will go up, both new demand and replacing existing demand with electricity.
Yeah, we've already seen that with crypto, the power demands of generating Bitcoin. So yes, demand is obviously increasing. But right now, what is it? About 30 gigawatts a day?
So the national energy market, which is essentially the East Coast, doesn't include Western Australia and sort of some of the big iron ore farms and things like that out in the middle of the desert, sort of averages maybe around 30 gigawatts at any point in time, but obviously surges up greater than that. And so when it gets hot and people run their air conditioners, or gets cold and they run their heaters, can go up and down. But, you know, we're probably sort of looking at, just for the East Coast market, probably 30 surging to 40 gigawatts. Mm-hmm. And so that's our starting point today, but I think predictions are that will probably, certainly by the middle of the century, will have at least doubled, I suspect.
Well, there's population growth and there's the electrification of current fossil fuel powered activities, and then there's new sources of demand, and you've mentioned the big obvious ones: crypto, artificial intelligence, data centers generally. Yeah, so if you're looking at least doubling that demand over the period of time we're talking about, which is now in 2050, that would be a reasonable foundational
plan. The bad news for you, Michael, or Bill, is that a civil nuclear reactor generates, depending on what kind of model you have, between 1 and 1.5 gigawatts. So if we are going to get to, you know, 60, 70, 80 potentially, Mr. Dutton's plan of 7 power plants that might do 10 gigawatts doesn't get us there. It maybe gets us to, best case, maybe 15%. Well, so we're still looking around under his plan for the other 85%.
Let's stay civil here. So I'm not even going to get angry with that strange formulation of the problem, because to me, it's the energy mix that is so important here. I don't think anyone is even suggesting that nuclear power is a 90% solution for Australia's energy need.
Isn't that what Mr. Littleproud is saying?
If I could just put this on the table, getting talked over by my colleague, that there's the parable of the Chinese gardener planting a sapling in the middle of this big open space. He's an elderly gardener, and the young gardener comes up to him and says,
I like how you are developing our energy policy on the basis of an ancient Chinese parable, but keep going.
The young gardener says to him, what on earth are you doing planting this little sapling here? Don't you know this tree will take 100 years to grow? Old gardener says, but when it has grown, it'll create beautiful shade and be a place for birds and people to enjoy. It'll be a wonderful addition to this park. And the young guy says, but what are you doing? It'll take 100 years to grow. He said, you're right. I should have planted it yesterday. Anything long-term has to be begun. That's the point I'm making.
Every journey starts with the first step. I agree, Michael. And when I was a much younger man, I'm still relatively young, but when I was much younger, I thought there was a place for nuclear. My view now is there's really no place left for nuclear because of those time frames. It's not 99 years. I think it's news to Peter Dutton that it's going to be 99 years, but it may not be 99 years, but it is a tiny part of our solution, a tiny part of the solution. I'll give you an analogy, okay? So we like
I'd just like to thank you for agreeing that nuclear is a part of the solution.
It is a potential part of the solution. It is a potential. I think there is potentially niche roles, but let me give you an example of a country that has adopted nuclear as part of its solution. Let's take Canada. So Canada, country that in many ways quite analogous to Australia, they have slightly larger population, larger
big
economy.
Big resource economy.
Lots of space. Canada has 19 nuclear reactors. That produces a grand total of 12.9% of their electricity requirements. So 7 power plants, and I'm not sure how many reactors that includes, that is Mr. Dutton's policy, I think will really only be a very small part of our energy mix, assuming it can be delivered.
Why do we not focus
on the 90%? Why are we obsessing around the 10%?
This could be a whole separate podcast, but there is the really big issue that you're pointing to here, and I agree with you. The world dropped the ball on nuclear power. If only those trees had been planted earlier, those saplings, more nuclear power would be online now.
Possibly.
We'd be much further on our transition to a fossil-free future.
That's really
with energy independence. So the lesson that you're teaching is, why haven't we already started and grown that option? Absolutely. And I think that's a sorry story across the world.
It just can't grow fast enough.
Well, this is back to what's happening. What are we actually producing now, and where's the electricity coming from? Clearly, we're meeting that 30 gigawatts a day because we're not having mass brownouts and blackouts. So that's the good news. There's concerns about the resilience of that system.
We do when large-scale baseload generators suddenly fail, and that will be a risk in the nuclear system. So if you replace large-scale coal generators with large-scale nuclear generators, and one drops out, and you let's say had two reactors with 2 to 3 gigawatts, there is a huge hole in your energy supply. So yes, we may actually, I think, have a less reliable grid with nuclear, because you are still going to be faced with that risk of big chunks of it unpredictably dropping out.
Well, you know, this obviously brings us to one of the core things to be understood about renewables, and I think there is some very positive facts, a very positive part of the renewable story in Australia, the growth in renewable supply over the last 5 years.
So hang on, are you on my side now?
I'm trying to have a civil debate and agree on some core facts, but
okay.
I thought that was our ground rule at the start. So the trend now is renewables are, I think, producing about 46% of Australian energy supply, and waxes and wanes.
On what period of time we're looking at. Instantaneously, it gets up to, at some points, over 60%, and in South Australia over 100%.
And as low as 30%.
So you average that out over months or weeks, you are getting up into the 30 to 40% kind of range.
Yeah. And then, but averages are important, but clearly the ups and downs are important too for what happens for particular days and actual consumers. The real success story in renewables, I think, has been rooftop solar, which I think is now delivering on average about 7.5 gigawatts a day, which when total overall demand is 30 gigawatts. You have to say that is a success.
It is a massive.
So thanks to all your mums and dads out there that have put those things on your roofs.
We lead the world in rooftop solar.
The other thing that's happened is there's been a growing contribution by big scale solar, but it's still the solar contribution is still dominated by rooftop.
Yeah, and I think that's a key point. So 4 years ago, there was virtually no large-scale solar in Australia. There was a lot of rooftop solar owned by mums and dads. There was virtually no large-scale solar. So we've gone from virtually nothing to sort of meaningful percentages in a very, very short space of time. And I think that, to me, really gets at the heart of the contradiction between nuclear and renewables, and that renewables scale really fast. And if I can put a call out to my hero, Ben Flivberg, again, the guru
Mega Projects, Flivberg.
Of mega projects. Yep. When he looks at across the span of mega projects, the ones most likely to succeed and the ones most likely to fail, the ones most likely to fail in terms of going over schedule, over budget and under delivering outcomes, the worst of all is nuclear waste disposal. The next worst, interestingly, is the Olympics. And then the third worst is civil nuclear power. If we look at the other end of the spectrum, the things that succeed are actually truly modular systems such as solar power and wind power. And the reason for that is if you want solar power, you put in some panels and they generate. You want some more, you put in some more panels, you put in some more panels.
Look, I won't be the only person.
Half a reactor.
I won't be the only person saying, we're going to keep this as a polite discussion. I'm not going to have you dragging down the Olympics. Paris Olympics are just about to start. I'm right behind the Aussie team. I think every Australian, besides a cringer, is right behind the team.
Is this a distraction, Michael?
I don't want to tie nuclear power and renewables to the Olympics. I think we're bigger than that. Aren't we bigger than that?
Are you admitting you're losing?
And the other point I make about the Olympics
take
is...
Take it up with Mr. Flivberg.
You can take...
Professor Flivberg. Well, he's a professor. He must know what he's talking about.
The professor can talk all he likes about the Olympics being a failure. I think the Olympic movement is one of the triumphs of humanity. Its resurrection after World War One was a stroke of genius.
All right, so how is this relevant?
Just saying there are other factors at play here, and that's important.
With nuclear energy?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I'll just go back to my earlier point that renewables are the most successful mega projects that you can find. Nuclear energy is the least successful, and that's based on from the guy who has looked at more mega projects than anybody else in the world.
I think we don't want to get away. We were talking about the contribution to the current energy mix.
Yes.
And if I could just mention, coal is still the heavy lifter in the Australian energy mix.
Yes.
And so what happens to replace that incredibly important baseload contribution you get from coal, given this growth in renewables, but that unfortunate variability we see, 30%, 60%, well, which is it? You know, for a reliable power system, you need reliable supply. So replacing that heavy coal contribution, it's not going to be gas, because at the moment, I think about 1.5% of power generation is coming from gas, which is an extraordinary goal, wasn't it?
The problem with gas is that the mega geniuses who've been running our economy decided to lock in all of our gas to overseas export and not reserve any of it for Australians, with the result that Australians are paying more for Australian gas than overseas customers, and we're almost getting into the ludicrous situation where those overseas customers are selling it back to us.
Yeah, so Australia
so
can't
gas
afford,
is not going to solve it.
We can't afford to buy the gas we produce, even though the gas we produce very cheaply and at scale, because we insist on selling it to ourselves at the highest price we can get for it on the international market.
Yes. So, and by the way, so people who say renewables, look at the price we're paying for electricity now, that's being driven by renewables. It is not being driven by renewables. Renewables are helping to keep the price down. That cost increase is being driven by Mr. Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which is driving up the cost of gas and coal around the world. And because we've locked ourselves into international markets, we are suffering
so
because of that.
So one part of our energy mix over the next 20 and 30 years, while we're doing this transition in our energy mix away from coal, would be a much more sensible policy around pricing of domestic gas, even with the ripple effect that might cause in our overseas markets? Because frankly, Australian energy resilience is so important. Us doing something like the West Australian government, but reserving a share of domestic gas for domestic consumption makes so much sense. We're sort of drifting
off topic, but it is astonishing that the one jurisdiction that is probably most subject to state capture of any government in Australia was the one that actually stood up to the energy industry and the gas industry and said, we are actually going to reserve West Australian gas for West Australian consumers, with the result that they pay the lowest price for gas of anybody in Australia.
Yep. So I just put that there as when we're talking about the role of different energy sources in our energy production, there's no way under current policy settings gas is a bridge to the future. It could be, but unless you're in Western Australia, it isn't.
No.
Now, so the question then is, all right, we've seen some phenomenal growth rates out of rooftop solar. We're starting to see with big scale solar, there was a surge in wind that seems to be dying down. Can renewables scale to meet 90% of our energy demand, and can it be sustained over time? And then the same question for nuclear.
Well, I think we've already answered the can nuclear scale.
Well, I haven't been given an opportunity there, but you tell me about renewables first.
Well, on nuclear it can't. Let me just answer this, because as we've already identified, Mr. Dutton's 7 nuclear power plants will probably best case do 10-15% of our requirements by the middle of the century. All of Western Europe at the moment is building 2 nuclear power plants. So for Australia to suddenly do not only those 7, but the additional ones you'd need to make a meaningful contribution to provide the bulk of our electricity, I'm not quite sure how that is going to happen, particularly when they seem to be running at a cost of, we're looking at Hinkley Point C is already up in the UK, is already up to £46 billion, so roughly, $80 to $90 billion. Olkiluoto 3, the Finnish one that was just completed, came in, actually was reasonably close to what it was meant to, but it still hit over close to $18 billion. So somehow, if we're going to be building all of Mr. Dutton's power plants, plus you need to maybe triple, quadruple, quintuple that to do the bulk of our electricity, we are looking at hundreds and hundreds of billions.
What I would say about that,
it cannot scale in the timeframes available to us.
What I would say about that is those European nuclear initiatives, they're all based on the lack of investment in nuclear power generation that we've lived with and now are suffering from of decades. So the peak of nuclear power building happened in the 70s, and we've been coasting on that long-term sensible investment without renewing it. So it's really, it's ironic, isn't it? There's been no renewal of nuclear power generation. And so the capacity to build these things has sensibly atrophied. And the government regulation has hobbled some of those international markets. So US nuclear power production.
Regulation
trying to export
nuclear
it.
Power is probably a
Could
good
I,
thing.
I'd just I like just to finish suggest. A couple of sentences here.
Come on already.
The US nuclear power providers like General Electric were hobbled in exporting their nuclear power systems globally because of regulation. I think the good news around climate change and environmental activism has been a more clear-eyed look at nuclear power and seeing it as part of the path to getting to net zero. You talk to young Australians, people that in previous generations would have been fervently anti-nuclear power, they're among the strongest advocates, and that's because they see it as part of the path to net zero. And that renaissance in investment in nuclear energy will do 2 things. Drive down the timescales and drive down the costs.
Okay, that was a nice homage to nuclear power, but there was not a lot of fact in there, Michael. So
South Korea and Japan can build nuclear power stations in 3 and 5 years.
Well, Japan is not building nuclear power stations at the moment.
But it can build them at those rates.
But it's not.
It already has them.
Okay, so let's look at sort of comparable countries. And people talk about nuclear renaissance going on. Well, there is not really a nuclear renaissance going on. So the UK is currently building 2 reactors at one station. The French are building 1. And the United States are not actually building any at the moment. They just completed 2 reactors in one station, but they pulled the pin on another project that was building two reactors at one station because it went so far over budget and was so far behind schedule. So I think what the world is realizing is that nuclear is just too slow and too expensive.
Well,
so,
I would say you're talking about countries that already have nuclear in their energy mix.
Yes.
So they've got a luxury we don't have. We need to create that same luxury for ourselves.
Well, I'll quote the Australian Energy Regulator, who just came out and said it would take 8 years to set up a regulatory framework to allow the construction of nuclear power plants in Australia. So if we add on sort of the 15-year construction time, so 15 and 8, 23 years. So if we add 23 on to, let's say, Mr. Dutton wins the next election, he'll come in 2025, we are kind of looking at 2050 for the first of his power plants.
However, I would say about the energy market regulator saying it takes 8 years. That sounds very America before the space race, before John F. Kennedy laid down that challenge of putting a man on the moon and energized the nation around it.
So,
and the other thing I'd say
is... You want to make this our moonshot?
Well, I think a sustained public initiative with the kind of weight of investment and interest around it can accelerate those timeframes. And frankly, if I was elected with a policy of putting nuclear power in place quickly and had a regulator tell me it would take 8 years, I'd be finding a new head of that regulatory agency.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hitler. Okay, I'll just run through some of the project times of recent Western nuclear projects. So Olkiluoto 3, which started generating last year, 23 years from the start of that project. So only 18 of them were construction. Flamanville 3, the French one, which is about to go online, 19 years. Hinkley Point C, latest estimate is 19 years. Vogtle 3 and 4 are 17 and 18 years. So the average there is around about 19 years. Are all countries with existing
Let me give you the International Atomic Energy Agency study that said 15 countries have built a total of 83 nuclear plants over the last 20 years. Among the 31 countries with nuclear power, it took on average 190 months to build each plant. During that period, Korea built a total of 13. Their average construction period was only 56 months, more than three times faster than other countries. And the fastest country was Japan, on average 46 months to build each plant and doing one in 36 months.
Japan has stopped. So, Michael, question to you. Do you see us, and when you look around at mega projects in Australia, being more akin to South Korea or more akin to Western Europe?
Yes, well, I have to say I've written something about Australia's ability to do large projects quickly, and we do not have a good track record. So building that new Optus sports stadium in Western Australia was about 15 years from idea to finishing it. It's a very impressive stadium, but it's not a massively complex, controversial public work like a nuclear power station. Putting the second Sydney airport in at Badgerys Creek, that's been over 40 years from site selection. It's still not operating. It should have some freight operating out of it probably next year.
And we actually know airports in this country. It's still 40 years.
Yes, and the...
And we know football.
The high point of large project failure, I think, if we take defence projects like the French submarine out of the mix...
That was only $3.5 to $4 billion down the toilet.
We'd have
Michael.
To say Snowy Hydro 2.0 is one of the worst.
And by the way, as the advocate for renewables, I would say Snowy Hydro 2 is not the way to do renewables.
Yes, because Billy the Bogged, that tunnel is still kind of funny. Tunneler. And the other big example of failed public project implementation is a nuclear waste repository, which the sites were selected twice and have been overturned each time by federal court challenges. So for nuclear power to happen, there needs to be a sea change in Australian public policy and regulation, because nothing will happen quickly without that.
Well, don't hold your breath waiting for that change. But waste, you raised the waste issue. How long has the world been generating electricity through civil nuclear power stations, Michael? How long has that been going on?
Since the 60s.
Wrong, Michael. My understanding is 1954 was the first civil nuclear power plant in the then Soviet Union. So 70 years.
Don't count the Soviets.
Well, they have been generating electricity and along with it waste. Now, while Mr. Dutton may sort of hold up Coke cans to sort of give us an indication of the scale of the waste problem, there are actually, by the figures I could find, 392,000 tons of waste fuel. Now, how many long-term waste storage facilities has the world created in those 70 years?
I think there's a very good one just opening in Finland as
Correct.
We speak.
That's it. That is it.
And this, I'd say two things about this, and they're both about opportunity. The first one is Australia is the most geologically stable continent on the planet. We have an enormous opportunity, which I think is part of our nuclear stewardship obligation as a supplier of uranium, to store a lot of that spent fuel.
You want to take the 392,000 tons
Some back. Of it, but the other big opportunity okay. related to that is the reprocessing opportunity. There's some outstanding research about the ability to reprocess spent nuclear fuel.
Yes, research.
And reuse
we
it.
Like research.
And you do it so many times. You do it so many times, you end up with hundreds of tons, not hundreds of thousands of tons. So yes, this is a case where further research and technological progress needs to happen.
Does it exist?
Back to my, this is a long-term endeavour.
Does
if you
it
want,
exist?
If you want a sustainable fossil-free energy mix, you need to make long lead investments. And storage and reprocessing, they're two of those.
So this is, this is interesting because I think, when I look at the nuclear advocacy, at the heart of it is this faith in technology. So technology will solve all the problems. So we've got 392,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel, but we haven't bothered to come up with a way to dispose of it. We can't even dig holes to put it in. So I think underpinning this is a view that sooner or later we'll find a way to reprocess it.
Well, we are finding those ways.
But we haven't got that way. But there is this faith in technology that is at the heart of the nuclear enterprise. Now, you can argue that a lot of it is misplaced. I think a lot of it is misplaced. But I don't understand why those people don't have the same faith in renewables technology, even though we can see in front of us that technology taking effect. So the efficiency of solar panels increasing exponentially, the cost of battery storage going down exponentially, we can see that occurring in front of us. So why don't we have the same faith in that technology?
Well, that's really interesting because I was going to put the same argument to you, that your side of this argument is based around the phenomenal promise and delivery of renewables that not so long ago was seen as just hypothetical. We're seeing some of that reality. Whether or not that can continue, we don't know yet. But we've seen technology as the solution start to deliver with renewables. So I have the same faith about nuclear power and solving the problems of storage and reprocessing. So I actually think I'm half agreeing with you here, even from my side of the argument. I think we both have faith in that human development of technology.
The trouble is, with the nuclear enterprise, it's faith, not action. We've had 70 years to build long-term
storage and disposal facilities.
We've done one.
But if you have a brief flowering of investment and research into nuclear, and then you coast on your laurels and do nothing for decades, you can't be surprised that the progress didn't continue.
Well, I'm not sure we have coasted and done nothing. I mean, there's the promise of small modular reactors. Well, one of the things I've been hearing a lot recently is people say, oh, gosh, it's this debate about nuclear. No one's listening to the engineers. Well, I was reading a piece put out by the engineers, the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering. They were looking at SMRs, small modular reactors. And they said, you can't expect that to be a reality in the Australian context until the late 2040s. Okay. So we are looking at another 25 years before we get small modular reactors that are commercially viable in the Australian context.
I bet if
that's the engineers talking.
I bet if you'd ask establishment outfits like the ATSE about how rapidly electric vehicles would become well-accepted consumable products before Tesla came along, they would have given you the same kind of time frames. So all I'm saying is the creativity we see in a whole lot of fields around energy and technology undercut these kinds of analyses. That's what I'll say about that.
This is the establishment speaking. Okay.
Well, it's just they would say that based on the facts they have in front of them, but they've been that
Don't
same
you
kind
hate
of analysis.
When people make conclusions based on facts.
The unfortunate thing for that kind of analysis is new facts rapidly overtake them. You know, I could say the same about the space industry, where the legacy approaches NASA had became too slow, too expensive. If you let new entrants in and you get the right government policies, including a healthy amount of subsidization, you can have outstanding new results.
I do agree there, in that if you want to keep doing nuclear the same old way, it's not going to solve our problems.
So you got to look.
You would need a completely new approach to nuclear. Unfortunately, we don't actually know what that is yet.
We do. We can look at the South Korean and Japanese experiences.
Except the Japanese have stopped.
But they still have the capacity to produce these things at scale. If they're not building them for themselves, what a wonderful opportunity to have them help us build ours. So the other thing that we haven't really talked about is, and what about some of the intractable problems? So you've talked about waste with nuclear.
Yes.
Waste with renewables. There is no feasible remanufacturing solution for batteries or used solar panels.
Well, you can recycle bits of them.
Well, it's just,
they're not going to sit there for 100,000 years.
It is clearly not economic.
Waste.
And the way we're making these things, you know, let's start at the horrible exploitation happening in the Congo with a lot of those rare earths and other essentials. Let's talk about the silicon production in Xinjiang with the forced labor and oppression of the Uyghurs. So people driving around in these Chinese electric vehicles and sticking these rooftop solar, they're feeling good about themselves, but there's a lot of human misery behind that in the production. And the waste, do we really think we're just going to export it to landfill in places like Indonesia? They're not accepting this stuff anymore. So I think there's some downsides. The other big one is your thing about scaling in time. Where do we get these renewable technologies and systems from if we want them fast?
The Chinese are telling us.
China has built a dominant market position. We'll be like Europe with Russian oil and gas, hugely dependent on a coercive energy provider. In this case, the Chinese, for our renewable technologies. And don't tell me they wouldn't use that for ill as well as good.
Well, you'll be surprised to know that this is an area where I do agree with you, in that, so supply chain security is important. If we go back to our sort of day job analysis, which is security in the defence of Australia, supply chain security is very important. And so, yes, this is an issue that we need to look at. And fortunately, the good guys around the world, the free world, are recognising this. And so the free world is reinvigorating the manufacture of wind turbines, of solar panels. It is really gripping up the issue of rare earths and how you break the coercive dominance of the Chinese in the rare earth market. So, yes, these are serious issues, but the good guys are looking at this and are trying to break the Chinese monopoly.
Well,
but it's not going to happen overnight.
Well, my concern there is the same concern you've raised about the whole nuclear power thing, which is the speed of action is not matching the speed of the problem.
No, but as of today, the Chinese are building lots and lots of solar panels, which we can buy quite affordably, and let's keep doing that. I will note the Australian government's Future Made in Australia program does involve solar panels. I am generally sceptical of essentially picking winners and direct subsidies in the commercial space. Remains to be seen how that's going to go.
I think that Future Made in Australia initiative is based on the butterfly effect. If a butterfly in Mongolia flaps its wings, it changes the weather in Latin America.
I thought it was Brazil.
Reason I think that is, it's such a tiny initiative, like that idea of producing some solar panels for a tiny, tiny investment compared to the scale of investment required. I think that is a marketing brand, not a program.
Yes, I think you are right to be skeptical there. But I'll get back to this other point that we made earlier, and that renewables scale really quickly. And so you have a lot more potential to do it faster. Now, yes, you may want to break your reliance on Chinese production. The whole world wants to break its reliance on Chinese production. But renewables scale really quickly.
I think that supply chain issue will really slow the renewables rate of scaling. But I think
it will never be as slow as nuclear, though. That's the problem.
I think that reliance on Chinese sourcing has to be broken, because that's a strategic and reliability issue. And we've just seen the problem of dependence on single suppliers with the mass outage of global internet, not Chinese internet, with Microsoft and CloudStrike. So over-economic dependence on a supplier based in China is all bad news. That will undercut renewable rollout for a while. So we're pretty much out of time. The other interesting interesting thing, this would be a whole different podcast, I think, is whether or not nuclear power has a potential role in Australia's energy mix, and whether or not renewables are the main answer. These are probably bridges to a future energy solution because of some of these just intractable issues around scaling and waste and cost, with nuclear fusion, clean nuclear energy, hopefully being humanity's sustainable future. Now, that would have sounded, that probably still sounds crazy to people, but I think to get hung up solely on the kind of energy solutions we have now and not think about the future of humanity under an even cleaner future would be a mistake.
Well, fusion is the unicorn. And if it rides in to save us, great.
Well, it's a unicorn that powers the sun.
So the problem is, unlike
most unicorns, it exists.
It exists in the sun. Back here in the real world, Michael, it doesn't exist. And it may well happen, and that would be terrific. It would be fantastic. But I don't think we can really base our planning around fusion showing up at a certain point.
I agree. I think for the foreseeable future, and this is 2050, 2060, the solutions we have are the ones we have to scale and use, and it's about the mix.
And the issue around those timeframes, if you think fusion's going to be here around 2050, that's about the time you're starting to get a return on your investment in fission, in traditional nuclear.
Well, and I would end my part of this debate by saying an energy system is best having an energy mix, and the right time to start long-term initiatives is yesterday, not today. And some of those investments are going to be in things that you turn out not to need. But if we could perfectly predict the future, we'd make a whole lot of better choices. So we have to live in the world we're in.
And on that point, I'll just go back to these engineers. What do they know? So the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering, who I would say they are in, and they are self-declared in the energy agnostic camp. So they're happy to look at any solution as long as it's viable, and they don't want to rule any solutions out. I'll just read their conclusion. In Australia, renewable technologies such as solar and wind are proven and mature, with widespread deployment underway. Large-scale nuclear will be outcompeted by renewables in the current time frame and does not appear a viable economic option in the short to medium term. So they leave open the longer term. Importantly, focusing on nuclear power now could distract from the transition away from fossil fuels, send mixed signals to industry, and hamper efforts to deploy renewable technologies at pace. While nuclear technology may eventually have a role in Australia, Australia's present critical technology mix focuses on renewable technologies, particularly wind, solar, pumped hydro, and battery storage, areas where Australia has a technological, geographic, and mineral advantage. I don't think I can put it any better than that, which is, yes, there may be a role at some point for nuclear, but don't let it be a distraction from the absolutely vital transition to renewables.
And I'll end by saying, I think this has been a civil nuclear debate, and I think the best thing for the country is to have more of that kind of public discussion. I hope the podcast has helped. Thanks very much,
Michael. Thank you, Michael.